Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who once described Caddyshack as an awesome documentary, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, lots of congratulations in order this week. And let's start with Brooks Koepka. Wait, before we congratulate him, so it comes out that he and DJ did indeed have a tete-a-tete, so to speak, in Paris post Ryder Cup. And you know what? Who cares? I mean, seriously, enough already. The only thing that concerns me is we, as the American team, should always pattern ourselves after Jack Nicklaus. Not only was he the greatest winner of all time with 18 majors, but he had more than that in runner-up finishes. And each time you saw him shake a hand, put his arm around his opponent, whatever, and congratulate him. He was as gracious in defeat, maybe more so, than in victory. And I wish our American teams would take that example to heart. It seems like the last two times we've lost the Ryder Cup, we've acted like petulant children instead of classy gentlemen. So guys, I don't care who you fought. I don't care who you disagreed with. I don't care about any of that. Just be better. Now, back to congratulating Brooks Koepka on being named Player of the Year. Really, who else were you going to give it to? I mean, the guy became only the third player in the modern era after Hogan and Strange to win back-to-back U.S. Opens. That's it. That's the list. And he added his third major, the PGA, in August in dramatic fashion, holding off Tiger Woods. Also, congrats are in order for the 2019 World Golf Hall of Fame inductees. Former chairman of Augusta National Golf Club, Billy Payne. Handicapped trick shot artist and motivational speaker, Dennis Walters. Peggy Kirk Bell of Pine Needles and Mid Pines fame. Former two-time LPGA major champion, Jan Stevenson. And two-time U.S. Open champ, Retief Goosen. Let me say I have zero issue with the first three, especially Billy Payne, who's done more to grow the game in the last 10 years around the world than anyone or any organization. And Peggy Kirk Bell, whose enshrinement kind of angers me, as it should have been done long ago when she was alive and to relish in the accolades that she would receive from around the world. There's never been a classier lady than Peggy Kirk Bell in the game of golf. And I'm not going to judge Jan Stevenson, as she did have two majors, and more importantly, brought much-needed attention to the tour for her attractive looks to go with her attractive play. My issue is with Retief Goosen. Look, I know he won two U.S. Opens. So did Lee Jansen, and so did Andy North. And I wouldn't put either of them in the hall. There are some compelling arguments for Goosen, and I've listened to them. For me, though, you can't just win a handful of events on the PGA Tour and have my lasting memory of you be a colossal choke in the final round of the 05 U.S. Open at Pinehurst. And really, that's the last time we've ever heard his name. I'm just protective of the hall. I've seen here in Charlotte how NASCAR has watered theirs down to being the hall of, well, pretty good. Golf needs to be like baseball. There have been years where no one got in that hall. Don't be afraid to do that. In case you were wondering, here's my criteria for the Hall of Fame. 1, 20 wins on the PGA Tour. 2, at least 2 majors. And I can be persuaded off one major with a TPC to go along with multiple World Golf Championships and Ryder Cup heroics. But other than that, I stand firm. And in the case of a tiebreaker, I ask myself this question. If Ben Hogan was doing a schoolyard pick for someone to play 18 holes for his life, who would he take? Anyway, as the golf season starts to wind down, even as the new season is beginning, we look back this week at a couple of my favorite chats. Chris Nashawaty, who's written the definitive book on the making of Caddyshack, and Chris Rodell, who's done the same with Arnold Palmer's life in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. But we begin with Caddyshack. Chris, before we get started talking about the movie Caddyshack and everything else, I got to know a couple things. I know you as a movie critic from Entertainment Weekly. Are you a golfer? Are you a sports fan?
I'm a huge sports fan, although my golf game is pretty weak. Not as bad as Rodney Dangerfield's in Caddyshack, but still not good.
Yeah, we'll get to the golf games of the cast coming up here in just a few minutes. So were you, and this is even weirder, because you're a film critic, I know that if the movie Caddyshack comes out right now, like every other critic, you're going to give it reviews that rival a Spinal Tap album. You're going to crush this movie, but yet, obviously, it's in your pantheon of guilty pleasures for you to take the time to write about it.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, when you tell people that you're a movie critic, they always think that your favorite movie is going to be like Citizen Kane or Vertigo or some Ingmar Bergman film from Sweden. But the fact of the matter is, when I was growing up, the movies that I was raised on were Animal House and Stripes and Caddyshack and Vacation. So those are the movies that are probably the closest to my heart.
Well, it sort of reminded me of, I love the story of the late Gene Siskel. And not that Saturday Night Live wasn't a critical success, but it was, or not Saturday Night, Saturday Night Fever. But he owned and bid on and paid big money, and he actually owned the John Travolta suit from Saturday Night Fever. And I thought, that is so weird. But, you know, everybody has their favorites.
Yeah, I mean, you know, us critics, we're fans. Highbrow, lowbrow, whatever it is, there are certain movies that just connect to you. And for me, I don't own any Caddyshack memorabilia, but it is a dear movie to me.
Chris Nashawaty is the author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Before we can talk about Caddyshack or the movie that begat it, if you will, Animal House, it's important that we recognize and talk about a guy named Doug Kenny. He is a good portion of the first half of your book. You can make an argument. Now, the name might ring a bell. Doug Kenny was the character of Stork in Animal House, the guy who led the band down the alley, if you're having trouble remembering the character. You can make an argument, and I think you made a pretty good one in your book, that Doug Kenny is actually sort of the godfather of contemporary American comedy.
I couldn't put that better myself. In fact, I wish I had that phrase when I was writing the book. Doug Kenny is a fascinating guy. And, you know, even when you talk to people like Chevy Chase and Bill Murray and you ask them who the funniest person they've ever known is, they, to a man, say Doug Kenny. He started at the Harvard Lampoon when he was going to school there, and he started the National Lampoon in 1970, which became, you know, sort of this real publishing sensation across between like Mad Magazine and The New Yorker, if you can imagine that. And then he wrote Animal House, and then he wrote Caddyshack. I mean, the run of comedy that he was on in the 70s was remarkable.
Yeah, I made a list here. You brought up Harvard Lampoon. That begat National Lampoon. You can make an argument that that begat Saturday Night Live, which begat Animal House, the Blues Brothers, and Caddyshack. And the guy at the beginning of all this and in the middle of all of it was Doug Kenny.
Absolutely. Yep, he is ground zero for this, for that generation of comedy. He is the man that, you know, not enough people know, but they certainly know his work if they don't know his name.
One other thing I want to touch on, we've mentioned it a couple of times before we get to Caddyshack, is you have to mention Animal House. Everybody loves Animal House. We all know the lines. We all repeat them. I had no idea what a groundbreaking comedy it actually was, that for a time it was the biggest money-making comedy in the history of American film. I think it was made for a budget of like $4 million, and in 1977 or whatever it was, it made $128 million. And to put that in math terms for you, that's so much money that Hollywood couldn't hide it, and they had to pay the writers points. And Hollywood never does that.
No, it's true. They joke that Hollywood accounting is, you know, designed so that you never see any more money after your original payday. But they could not hide the money that that movie made. It's, you know, it was something new in comedy. It was subversive and satiric, and it took no prisoners. And it coming on the wake of something like Smokey and the Bandit, or you know, George Burns as God and Oh God, or you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, palling around with an orangutan in those monkey movies he made in the 70s. This was something that was a total breath of fresh air and wasn't afraid to break a little bit of China in the process.
Chris Nashawaty is the author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, let's get to Caddyshack, and let's start with some of the casting. Now we look at the cast, and they're Mount Rushmore-esque. But back in the day, let's sort of explain who everybody was at the time. Let's start with Rodney Dangerfield. Who was he in 1979?
Yeah, you know, Rodney has a really interesting backstory. You know, he had started off in the 60s as a comedian, in the 50s actually as a comedian, and his career never really took off. You could argue that he was a little bit ahead of his time, but he had to give it up, and he became an aluminum siding salesman, and eventually started to go back to comedy in the 60s, where he started to finally catch fire. And then, before Caddyshack, he had been on this really volcanic run of performances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And every time he was on stage, he would just leave people, you know, just sobbing, crying, because he was so funny. And when he was cast in Caddyshack, even though he hadn't really been in any movies before and didn't know how movies were made, they were considering Don Rickles. But Dangerfield was so hot in The Tonight Show, they decided to go with him.
It's important to point out to so many who have never lived at a time where they didn't have 400 channels on their TV, just how big a deal it was to kill on The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson, every night when there were three networks and later four networks, he had a captive audience of tens of millions of people, and this was a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, he was really a kingmaker. To go on Carson and to do so well that he called you over to the couch after your set as a comedian, that was like being anointed the next big star. And, you know, every stand-up comedian, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, whoever, has a story about being called over to that couch, and it's like, you know, it's Christmas, it's your bar mitzvah, it's whatever. It's just your life is never the same the next day.
Chevy Chase was one of the original Not Ready for Primetime players that opened up on Saturday Night Live during that show's first season. He became the first real breakout star in comedy. When this movie was being made in 1979, reading what you were writing, the point in his career, it reminded me of Eddie Murphy when he did 48 Hours and then Beverly Hills Cop. He was sort of at that point where he could get any movie made that he wanted as long as he was the star.
That's actually a perfect comparison, Eddie Murphy. I mean, Chevy Chase was the only character in the cast in the first season of SNL who not only was featured in a way that the others weren't, but he would actually say his name on TV. You know, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not, when he was doing Weekend Update. And he was pretty savvy about that. He knew that was a way to turn himself into a household name. And he really popped on that show. And when he left after the first season to have a movie career, the cast members who were left behind, you know, Belushi and Aykroyd, all those guys, were a little resentful that he had left. And when Bill Murray replaced him, he was sort of became the Avenger in a way. When Chevy came back to guest host in 1978, he and Bill Murray got in a fist fight because as the new guy, Bill Murray felt like he had to stand up for the cast members. And that led to a lot of tension that a lot of people feared would play out again on the set of Caddyshack.
There's a memorable scene in Caddyshack where that tension gets taken care of. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. Chris Nashawaty, author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, is our guest taking Dead Aim. Two more pieces of casting that I thought were interesting in your book. One, we all knew Ted Knight as Ted Baxter on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. The fact that he only won two Emmys, being nominated, I think you wrote six times, is stunning to me because he was perfect on that show. And he was hysterical in Too Close for Comfort. What I was totally unaware of was Ted Knight's military background. That was stunning to me. I had to read that twice.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Knight had lived such a life before he even became an actor. As you mentioned, he was a World War II hero. You know, he was on the front lines, awarded multiple times, and you know, he had been a ventriloquist in Providence. You know, he did kiddie shows. He did everything before Mary Tyler Moore came along. And you know, he had a little bit of trouble with the wild and crazy cast in the set of Caddyshack, who were, you know, they were all improvisers who would make up their own lines and not stick to the script. And Ted was a professionally trained actor who thought that, you know, you come to the set every day knowing knowing your lines, and that's what you do. And it drove him kind of crazy, and I think a lot of the rage that he had, especially with Rodney, who was just making up stuff left and right, that played really well for his character, Judge Smales.
The book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, and when we return, more from author Chris Nashawaty as he takes dead aim at maybe the most beloved golf movie of all time. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. The book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, and now more with author Chris Nashawaty.
It's hard to imagine anyone other than Michael O'Keefe playing Danny Noonan, but someone who was really close to getting the part, and this is going to be even wilder, was Mickey Rourke. I can't picture it would have been so much darker of a character. Can you imagine brooding Danny Noonan?
It really did come down to those two, and it was a bit of a toss-up. They went with O'Keefe because he was a better golfer. But, yeah, I mean, Mickey Rourke is a pretty, pretty intense dude. It's not a wacky comedy with Mickey Rourke as Danny Noonan by a long shot.
The genesis for the idea of the movie Caddyshack did not come from Doug Kenny or Harold Ramis or anyone else who pitched it in Hollywood. It came from a guy named Murray, but not the Murray we've talked about.
Yeah, Brian Doyle Murray was the third writer with Doug Kenny and Harold Ramis. And the story was really his. And it was a very personal story because the Murray boys, well, there were 9 Murray kids in all. And they were a working class family in a pretty ritzy neighborhood just north of Chicago. And in order to pay for Jesuit school, their father made them work as caddies and shag boys during the summer so they could pay tuition. And, you know, when you're a caddy and a shag boy, you come up with a lot of crazy stories and you meet a lot of colorful characters. And so when it was time to pitch the follow-up to Animal House, they went back to Brian and they said, you know, tell us more about this Caddyshack idea. And that's what they pitched. And it's a very personal story to the Murray family.
You can't think of Caddyshack at all without thinking of the other Murray, and that's Bill Murray as Carl, the greenskeeper, or the assistant greenskeeper, excuse me, in Caddyshack. But when the camera started rolling, the character wasn't even fleshed out. It wasn't even in the first 2 or 3 drafts of the script when Bill actually showed up on set, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Carl Spackler was a complete afterthought. The studio wanted one more star in the movie, and Brian obviously thought of his brother Bill, who at the time was just starting to take off on Saturday Night Live. So they got Bill to come and do it, but, you know, the character was such an afterthought that they hadn't written any lines for him. But knowing what a great improviser Bill was, you know, with his training at Second City in Chicago and on Saturday Night Live, they just knew that if they just left some blank pages for his scenes, he would appear on the set, they'd roll the camera, and he'd come up with gold, which is exactly what he did, because that Cinderella story scene that he does, that's in one take, and that's all ad-libbed.
Let's talk about improvisation and ad-libbing, because I don't think it's done nearly as much today in film as it used to be. And maybe it's a gap in talent that doesn't exist out there or that Hollywood doesn't allow it to happen. I don't know. But I'm going to give you a list of scenes just in Animal House and Caddyshack that I know were improvised, and they're some of the most famous scenes in the world. You have Belushi on the stairs with Stephen Bishop smashing the guitar in Animal House. You have the whole cafeteria scene with Belushi and look at me, I'm a zit. Okay, you have Bill Murray doing the Cinderella story, and I want to talk about this scene now where you have Bill Murray and Chevy Chase in Carl's shack where he's growing a breed of grass that you can play on and smoke. All of these scenes 100% improv, just with a premise given. That's amazing. Those are some of the biggest scenes in the history of comedy.
It is amazing. And I think the reason why they don't do it anymore, I think there are some actors who still do it a little bit. Someone like Will Ferrell, and some of the Judd Apatow comedies, they do a little improv. But movies have become so expensive now, and they're such huge investments, that no one is going to risk that kind of money on going into a film without a script. But back in 1979, when they were making Caddyshack, you know, we had a first-time director, a first-time producer, stars that hadn't been in movies before. And the movie didn't cost all that much. It cost $6 million. And so they just let these guys, since they were coming off Animal House and hoping for another Animal House, do whatever the hell they wanted. And that's what they did, and they just miraculously spun it into gold.
The book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Author Chris Nashawaty is our guest, taking Dead Aim. Just a quick aside, one more piece of casting that I had written down here that when I read it, I laughed out loud. For those of us who grew up and came of age in the late 70s and early 80s and remember the memorable jingles and TV commercials, when I saw this on the page and then I remembered the face, I laughed out loud. Tell everybody who Dr. Beeper was better known as on television.
Dr. Beeper was played by an actor named Dan Rezin, who was a sort of a jobbing, struggling actor whose previous claim to fame was as the Tidy Bowl Man.
Unbelievable! He was the Tidy Bowl Man in the boat in the toilet.
Perfect.
It was fantastic. Hey, as a member of Rolling Hills Country Club, legit, Rolling Hills Country Club in Monroe here in Charlotte, it pleased me to no end to see that same name for the club used as Bushwood. Does the club still exist?
It does. And now they have a different name now. It's called Grand Oaks. So you may be the only Rolling Hills now. But, yeah, it was Rolling Hills in Davie, Florida, and they originally wanted to shoot it in Illinois because the Murrays were from Illinois, and that's where they sort of envisioned it. But, you know, when they decided that they were going to shoot it in the fall, you can't really make a breezy summer comedy by Lake Michigan in the fall. So they went down to Florida and found this course that fortunately didn't have many palm trees and sort of looked like it could pass for Illinois, and they proceeded to just devastate the place, you know, with that giant explosion at the end of the film.
I'm glad you brought that up because I've always wondered how in the hell they talked a club into letting them blow it up. Because this is the late 70s. We're not in the computer-generated age of creating explosions out of thin air. There was real dirt and pyrotechnics being used at a country club. How did they convince the club to let them do this?
One simple answer: they didn't tell them. They showed the board of Rolling Hills in Florida the script, and the explosion was in the script, and the board said, look, you know, if you're going to do this movie here, you have to change the script. And they said, oh no, don't worry, the script will be changing. But what they didn't tell them is that part of the script wasn't going to be changing. So on the day of the explosion, one of the producers took all of the board members from the club out to lunch, lured them off campus, and then they just, while the mice was away, the cow was away, they just blew the whole thing up, and it was such a huge explosion, but they were in the flight path to the Fort Lauderdale airport, an incoming plane radioed into the control tower that there had been a plane crash.
The very first scene filmed for Caddyshack would become one of the most famous scenes in the movie. Yet the way it was filmed on day one never saw the light of day. Sort of explain what I'm talking about.
I think you're talking about the Dalai Lama scene?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So the Dalai Lama scene, there's a very not funny version of that speech in the script. And they gave it to this actor who was just sort of this local Florida guy who was a war veteran and, frankly, a little bit off. And not in a funny way. And when he tried to do the scene, he just couldn't do it. And Harold Ramis, the director, thought, geez, you know, this is the first day, and I know I'm gonna get fired when they see this thing back in Hollywood. So they decided to just move on, get rid of this guy, and they figured when Bill Murray showed up, they would just give the scene to him, and they did, and he just turned it into something that's like poetry.
You mentioned Rodney Dangerfield, and he is Al Chervik. He's unbelievable. His very first scene that they filmed was the infamous pro shop scene. Rodney being used to being on stage and getting laughs. This almost seems sort of foreign because you think of the consummate performers being in front of cameras all the time, but I guess this really wasn't the case. Rodney thought that scene, in which he killed, by the way, he thought that he was bombing over and over again. Why?
Well, I think most stand-up comedians have a slightly neurotic edge and are a little bit insecure. But yeah, Rodney was not familiar with how movies are made. And so he's out there giving it his all, making jokes, some that are in the script, some that aren't. You buy a hat like this, I bet you get a free bowl of soup, all of that. He's doing that. And he realizes that no one's laughing. And he's like, I am tanking here. What's going on? And he was really insecure about it. And they finally had to pull him aside and say, no, Rodney, you're doing great. The problem isn't that people aren't laughing. It's that we can't laugh because we'll ruin the take if you hear the crew laughing, on film. So it took him a while to get the hang of things. He didn't even know what the word action meant to start the scene. Eventually they just had to call out, Rodney, do your bit, instead of action at the beginning of all of his scenes.
You mentioned the bowl of soup line. Yet another completely improvised line that's one of the most famous in American comedy. Chris Nashawaty, our guest, Taking Dead Aim, author of the book Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Want to talk real briefly about the dynamic between Ted Knight and Rodney Dangerfield. We touched on this earlier. Ted Knight, the consummate, coming from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the ensemble, the script is the Bible sort of actor, and Rodney, who's completely off the cuff, and the anger we saw on screen from Ted Knight's character, Judge Smales, that may not have taken much acting on his part.
No, I mean, he really was upset with the way that everyone else on the movie was making the movie. It just went against everything he knew about acting. And not only that, but, Ted Knight was older than most of the cast and the crew, who were young and fun and in their 20s and looking to have a good time. And they were in Florida in 1979, which is pretty much the gateway into the country for cocaine. So there's a lot of drug taking on this set, and Ted just wasn't having it. So, Rodney just sort of saying whatever the heck popped into his head just went against everything that Ted believed in, and he had trouble keeping up. So when you see him just seething in those scenes, it's just, that's what we call method rage.
Get you out of here on this, and this goes to you as a film critic. I was just, as we were talking, trying to think of comedies in the last 10 to 12 years. Big successful ones, maybe The Wedding Crashers, maybe the first Hangover movie. Those are ones that really made me laugh out loud. I don't quote those movies. I don't have their quotes memorized. What is it about these comedies, other than the fact that Bill Murray was in them? Stripes, Meatballs, Caddyshack. I know Bill wasn't in Animal House, but I'm going to throw that in there too. What is it about those movies, those comedies, the Blues Brothers from, 79 to 82? What is it that resonates even to this day with people that they memorize lines and know them, and it doesn't happen today?
It's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer. I have a couple of theories. The first is that it's like the NBA. As great as everyone is, as many star players as there are, there isn't a Jordan, a Magic, a Bird. You know what I mean? Yes, there's LeBron, but it just seems like the stars were better back in the day. And with the movies, I'd argue that there, a movie like Anchorman or the Austin Powers movies are pretty quotable, but my God, it seemed like there was one coming out every week back in the 70s and 80s. And I just think that those movies, they knew how to make comedies better back then.
Oh, and one more little thing. We talked real quick about the Dalai Lama scene. The poor child who had the pitchfork shoved in his chest for about 7 hours once Bill Murray got there and started filming it was a guy named Peter Burkrot. Now, if I were to ask you what Peter Burkrot is doing today, specifically that has to do with your book, what would you say?
I would say that young man who had a pitchfork aimed at his throat for about 7 hours with Bill Murray, he now reads audiobooks at Audible, and he read the audiobook for Caddyshack, The Making of a Cinderella Story.
The book, Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, the author, Chris Nashawaty. And up next, Chris Rodell to talk about his book that takes dead aim at Arnold Palmer's life in his beloved Latrobe, Pennsylvania. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management. Located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Chris Rodell is a golf writer and resident of Latrobe, Pennsylvania, birthplace and lifelong home of Arnold Palmer. His book, Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King, chronicles just how much of a hometown kid Arnie always was. Chris, before we dive into your book about Arnold Palmer, as a current resident of Latrobe, Pennsylvania, you have to answer a question for me that I've been dying to know for years.
Yes.
Fred Rogers was born in March of 1928. Arnold Palmer was born in September of 1929, both in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. So they're within a year class-wise of each other. You can make an argument that no two people from one place in the world have done more for children than Arnold Palmer and Fred Rogers. Yet I never come across anything that has them working together on a project or being involved charitably together. Am I wrong, or did they really not have an involvement even though they were so charitable, both of them?
That's a great point. You know, searching my memory now, I can't recall any incident of that either. I do remember that Mr. Palmer was so competitive when I told him that Fred Rogers had won the Congressional Medal of Freedom prior to him. He seemed a little miffed.
Oh, my God.
He's the only guy in the world that would be competitive with Fred Rogers.
Oh, my God. That's a fantastic story. You know, Arnold is synonymous with Latrobe. Are there any shrines or anything to Mr. Rogers there? Just wondering.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a statue downtown and McFeely Rogers Park. So he's well represented and very beloved for all the same reasons as Mr. Palmer.
I've just always been curious about that, and I was searching and searching this morning to find a common cause in Latrobe or something that they worked together on. I couldn't even find a picture of them together.
No, I've seen one picture of them together, but they really didn't have that much to do with one another. It wasn't any hostility or anything. They were friendly, but their paths never crossed. I think part of it might have been that they were both two successful people working their own ways.
Oh, yeah, they were completely different personality-wise and field and everything else. I mean, I get that.
Yeah, so they didn't need to overlap to help the town. But that's a very good question. I'll have to talk to some people about that.
Chris Rodell is the author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the things that caught my eye immediately was a golf writer or someone who has written at the time in the world of golf in 1992 moves to Latrobe, Pennsylvania and does not start pestering Arnold Palmer. Did that raise more red flags than if you did go to pester Arnold Palmer?
No, they were very happy about that. They did not like being pestered. And I would show up there. I was doing those Amazing But True golf calendars, you know, those page-a-day things you tear off.
Loved them.
Yeah, and so did Arnold Palmer. He was like my number one fan. And I would drop them off at Christmas, one for Doc Giffen and one for Mr. Palmer. And then I would leave them alone. And eventually Doc called me up to golf. And we still didn't have a real breakthrough chumminess-wise until we got to the bar. And he said, Chris, what'll you have? And he's very austere and very proper. I said, I'll have a double Jack Daniels on the rocks, no straw. And he put his arm around me. He said, my man. That was my bourbon order.
You brought up a great name, Doc Giffen. Explain to people exactly who Doc Giffen was and who Doc Giffen is.
Well, he's a man that if anybody has the audacity to write a book about Arnold Palmer, it should be Doc Giffen. But he promised him years ago he'd never write a book and never betray any secrets like that. I never made that promise, and I said that I was lucky enough to be part of the solar system, but I was like Pluto, and people argue whether Pluto's even a planet. Doc Giffen is Earth. If Arnold was the sun, Doc Giffen was Earth. He was there for 50 years, and I have such high regard for the man, and I really said to my wife, I said, I go, this is could be dangerous. I said, if Doc doesn't like this book, we're going to have to leave town.
How is Doc now? I would have thought that even more than family almost, he was closer than a brother to Arnold Palmer. I would have thought that Arnold's loss both professionally and personally, would have been so devastating that it would have been hard for Doc to bounce back. How is he doing now? What is he doing?
He's doing great. You know, I still see him for lunch once in a while, and Doc and I are both fans of Survivor, which struck me as very odd that he likes Survivor like I do. But we always get together and talk about Survivor on Thursday afternoons, and he's doing good. I think the reason that it didn't devastate him was because he had such a great relationship with him for so many years that he'd done everything he could, you know, that there was nothing left in the tank, and he lost his friend, and he was devastated by that, but he moves on. But I'm glad you bring him up. You know, he's just a great man. I'm very fond of him. A lot of times when people would say, what's it like to work with a legend, I would go right to Doc Giffen and say, Doc Giffen is great to work with.
I've been around celebrities in the music business and in the movie and TV business and in the athletic arenas for the better part of 20 or 30 years. And I have seen a lot of people who were very famous and very successful who were very uncomfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
I don't think, maybe with the exception of Garth Brooks,
that's a good analogy.
I have ever met anyone who enjoyed being who they were more than Arnold Palmer enjoyed being Arnold Palmer. Do you think that's a fair statement? That no one loved being who they were more than him?
Yeah, that's a great point. He never ducked from celebrity, you know, that people would come up and see him in the streets and say, there's Arnold Palmer. He never minded taking pictures with people, and that he reveled in being who he was, and he was just so happy. There's a story that one of the women who worked at the halfway house said 2 weeks before he died, he was sitting out in his golf cart on number 10 hole by himself, and it was twilight, and she said she looked at him, and he had just had this smile on his face. He was all by himself looking around at the trees and the golf course that he had built and maintained for all these years, and she said he just looked so at peace with himself, and that's an image I like to have of him, that he was, you know, toward the end of his life, 2 weeks away, in fact, and he just was so content with all he'd done. And he was really a great man. We really miss him still every day.
Chris Riddell is the author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. The entire focus of your book is Arnold Palmer and his life in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. I know he spent several months a year, you know, down at Bay Hill, but the majority of the time he loved to live right there, just a few hundred yards from where he grew up in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And I would think on the surface, for those that don't know, and this may get back to the point of Arnold being so comfortable in his own skin, that one would think someone that famous, that they would want to stay close to home because it would give them a sense of being grounded, and they would feel like no one would ask anything of them. And on the surface, maybe, but Arnold Palmer, I almost get the idea he would have been offended if he didn't have things asked of him, if the Rotary Club didn't come to him and ask for a donation for the high school, if those things didn't happen, that would have bothered Arnold more, right?
Oh, that's a good point. You know, he was happy to help these community organizations, and he had the means to do it. And the one reverend that said, after he passed away, he said, he goes, what we're going to miss most is he always cut the check. You know, you would go up and ask him to help you out, and he would always sign a check, some donation. There's a story about a shop with a cop that the state police do to help with kids. And he thought he would get $5,000 from Mr. Palmer, and he ended up getting $50,000. And he said, Mr. Palmer, can I release this to the public and let the papers know? And he said, no, let's just keep that between you and me. But he completely funded the program for 5 years out, and it's self-sustaining, and nobody knew about it.
How many stories like that did you come across? Of all the things we know about Arnold, and they are well documented, all you need to do is look at the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Children in Orlando, and there's hospitals all over the country that show his magnanimous charity. But how many of the stories like that with the shop with the cop did you find? The stories that no one knows.
I thought I knew him pretty well. I interviewed him over 100 times over 20 years, studied him, knew people that knew him, but until I sat down and got to talk to the people that helped me write this book, I didn't know him the way I thought I did. He was incredibly generous and incredibly giving of his time, and you know, he would, the most important person in the world was the person that was right in front of him. He would talk to that person. There's a great story that Sam Saunders told at the memorial. He called him up And Mr. Palmer answered the phone. He said, "Where are you? Or who are you talking to?" He said, "I'm talking to the president." And Sam said, "The president of what?" And he said, "The president of the United States." He goes, "Why did you answer the phone in the Oval Office?" He said, "Because I wanted to talk to you." You know, he just had a great appreciation of one-on-one human relationships.
I'm glad you brought up the memorial service. You were there. You were in the cathedral when that was going on.
Yeah.
And you brought up something else, and I thought of this, and I spoke with my son about it last weekend when we bumped into Jim Nance here at Quail Hollow. Jim Nance is great at what he does.
Yes.
His best moment, and you mentioned this in the book, his best moment, in my opinion, that he's ever had were the 15 minutes that he spent in front of that group at Arnold Palmer's memorial service.
It was wonderful, wasn't it?
All I could think was, not only is this wonderful, but selfishly I'm thinking, whoever's got to follow Jim Nance, they need just to just walk up there and say, "I loved Arnold," and walk off. Because you're going to just pale by comparison. Look, I was bawling like a baby in my living room. There couldn't have been a dry eye in the house.
Yeah. Nance said he was more nervous about that than any of the Super Bowls he's ever done.
Look, to me, and I realize I'm a golfer, but to a lot of people in the world, I mean, this was a man who dined with queens and dined with people in pool halls. It was a more important audience and a wider audience than he may have ever had for a Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah, probably. Tom Ridge said that, and Tom Ridge is the former governor of U.S., a Vietnam veteran, and the Department of Secretary of Homeland Defense. He said it was the greatest memorial he's ever been to. He said that it should be taped and shown in schools on how to memorialize someone and who deserves that kind of memorial. I said I think it would be better as a Broadway play.
It was incredibly moving. It really was. And having been around Vince Gill for the last 25 years, and you brought up him, Vince Gill was exactly who Vince Gill is, and just so on point. Chris Rodell has written a book called Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about some of the fun stuff in the book. Talk to me about Arnold's dog and the tennis ball.
Well, that was one of the first times I interviewed him, and I was very nervous. I still had this reverence for him. And that was the time I was able to understand how to connect with him on a juvenile level that he enjoyed. Well, I was up there, and he was signing autographs, and he spent 3 hours every day signing autographs from people from all over the world and sending them back. And I was doing a story about golfers and their dogs, and I said, "What's an old rule stickler like you doing with a dog named Mulligan?" And he said, "You know, there's nothing wrong with a Mulligan. We have that's our rule here at the club. You're allowed to take a Mulligan on the first tee." I said, "Is he a good on-course dog?" He said, "No, he's lousy. He chases after balls and slobbers them up." He said, "It's probably because I spend an hour every day out here hitting a tennis ball with a wedge into the net, and he chases after him." And I just thought, I go, man, would that be special. I said, "I'd like to see that." And he put his pen down. He got a gleam in his eye, and he said, "Come on." And it was like we were playing hooky, you know, just like you were running away from school. His duties were over. And he was sitting there. And then during that next 25 minutes or so, we just bantered. You know, we talked sports. We talked politics. And I just thought, this is my moment. You know, I can say that I had this time with Arnold Palmer. Little did I know I'd be fortunate enough to spend many, many hours like that with him later. But that was a special moment to watch him with a pitching wedge hitting a tennis ball and watching this dog soar after it in his backyard.
Chris, I was thinking about a meeting that I had with a radio station owner that I was working for when I was 22 years old, and he took me out to eat to Steak and Ale, and I thought, wow, this is the nicest place I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
And he ordered us steaks, and he ordered me a bourbon, and he ordered me a glass of red wine. And he sat them both in front of me, and I thought, okay, this is really, really odd. And he told me something. He said, "Son, you need to be as comfortable in the boardroom with this high-dollar wine as you are in the back room with this whiskey."
Yeah.
And I don't think I can think of anyone in sports who better epitomized being comfortable in both worlds and being equally accepted in both worlds as Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, the working title of the book for a long time was One Part Champagne, Three Parts Beer. People were asking me, you know, how was I feeling it when he died? And I said, I feel one part despair, three parts euphoria. Despair because he's gone, euphoria because I got to spend time with him. And that is all a play on the Arnold Palmer tea, which is one part lemonade, three parts tea. But I said Arnold Palmer, the man, was like Latrobe. He was one part champagne, three parts beer. You can have that range of socialization. You can literally have drinks with the Queen on one night, and then the next night be at the town hall, fire hall, drinking with the guys down there.
You mentioned dining with the Queen or perhaps having a beer at the Tin Lizzie. This is a man who was a member at Augusta National, could get on any golf course in the world he wanted at a moment's notice with a snap of his fingers. Yet you called him a lazy golfer, and I love this. It wasn't about his work ethic or his habits. It was that he was just as happy walking across the street to Latrobe Country Club.
Yeah, that always irritated me. I said, if I had his means, I would be at Pebble Beach on Monday. I would be at Augusta on Tuesday. I would be at all these places. I'd never be home. And I said to him, I said, you know, you could play Laurel Valley right down the street, 15 minutes. You could play Oakmont. It's an hour away. Or if you wanted, you could get in your plane, fly to Augusta, and be back by dinner. I said, why do you play Latrobe day after day? He said, it's just so close. And I love that. You know, there's no pretension about him at all. I marched it off. It was 1,987 paces from his front door. And I swear, if there was a course that was 1,986 paces from his front door, he'd play that instead.
One of the great questions you can ask someone of Arnold Palmer's success in the game of golf is, when was the last time you paid for blank? In other words, when was the last time you paid for golf balls? When was the last time you bought a golf club? When was the last time you paid greens fees? And I love this story the most, because the last time someone made Arnold pay greens fees was it's one of the bucket list courses in America, and he never went back.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Bandon Dunes. And they went out there to play. They'd heard so much about it. I've never played it either. And he heard so much about it. And they went to the clubhouse, and they said, that'll be $100, Mr. Palmer. And he was very surprised. And I speculated he paid less than any man on earth to play that much golf, because his father was a green superintendent, so he played free then. In college, he played free, and then in the service, and then as a professional. And they said that became like a tagline out there, that they even charge Arnold Palmer out there. But he said he'd never go back.
Chris Rodell has written a book, Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. You spent many, many hours talking with Arnold Palmer. Part one of the question, did you ever have a point in all of those years when you were sitting there that you forgot that you were talking to one of the most famous people on the planet and in the game, and it was just some guy you knew? Or were you always aware?
No, it would drift in and out. You know, like, I was raised by the son of one of these Army guys that just absolutely revered him. And so I carried that with me, that I had my father as ghost haunting me, saying, don't you screw this up. Don't offend Mr. Palmer. But then there's the line I use that I can't really say on the radio. I said, I just want you to know how much I enjoy hearing your insights, Mr. Palmer. And he said, I enjoy you coming in here and blowing so much sweet smoke. And he said a description of where the smoke went. And I thought, man, this guy is just like my buddies at the bar down the street. And he is so much a Latrobe guy. And one of the things I love about him, he was worth about $800 million when he died. And he would have been treated just the same as if he was worth $800 in this town. People wouldn't have treated him any differently. They'd have been still happy to see this joyful, cheerful, determined, bold man walk into the bar. Arnie's here. And that's the way it was, no matter what he was worth.
Outside of any recordings you have of interview sessions or any notes you have from interview sessions, is there something that you have, a memento, if you will, of the times that you spent with Arnold Palmer that means more to you than any other?
Well, I just got one, in fact, posthumously. A week ago. Prior to that, it was a picture of me interviewing him with Doc in the background. These interviews were just so much fun, so much bantering. And I remember Doc said after after Mr. Palmer had passed, he goes, well, I guess that's all done for. And I said, no, I have an idea. Seance. But we didn't go that far. But just recently, somebody gave me the hat and the golf glove that was on his cart since the last time he drove it. And that hat, to put that on my head, they said how much they liked the book and they wanted me to have this, and I was just thrilled with it. You know, I don't know whether I want to wear it or preserve it in a museum-type display, but I was very touched by that, to have the last hat that Arnold Palmer wore on a golf course.
That's Chris Rodell, author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. Hope you also enjoyed Chris Nashawaty talking about arguably the most beloved golf movie of all time in his book, Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now, articles on the Hall of Fame inductees and a really cool video where Pro Tracer was attached to the swing of legendary Mo Norman. It is sick. It's unbelievable. Hey, weather-wise, guess what? Fall has finally arrived in the QC post Michael. So plenty good to go to get your golf on. And if you do tee it up this weekend and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.